Welcome to this special edition of the Expert HR podcast, taking a look back at the key legislative developments of 2018 and looking forward to what we can expect in 2019. I'm Laura Merrilies, an employment law editor here at Expert HR. I'll be hosting today's discussion and I'm joined by some of my colleagues from the team.
I'm Susie Munro from the employment law team.
I'm Stephen Simpson, also an employment law specialist.
I'm Noelle Murphy and I'll be giving the HR practice perspective.
And I'm Fiona Cumming from the employment law team.
So I think it's fair to say that the General Data Protection Regulation, or GDPR, has dominated the HR agenda this year, Susie.
Yes, for many people working in HR, 2018 will be remembered as the year of the GDPR, and it definitely preoccupied us here at Expert HR for a lot of the year. So if you were responsible for carrying out the HR data audit, creating a data register, putting together new privacy notices and policies for your organisation, the first half of the year may have been particularly painful, unless, of course, you got it all done and dusted in 2017.
Okay, so if you aren't in that fortunate group that did and you are behind and you've still got boxes to tick, what can you do?
So if you're not sure whether your organisation has done everything it should have, it's not too late to get on the case, and there's plenty of practical resources on Expert HR, and I would go to the GDPR trending topic page where you can see all the resources that we've got.
Okay, and what happens now with the GDPR?
So you might have been relieved to get past the 25th of May, having done what was needed, but you can't just sit back and relax thinking it's all over. You need to keep on top of GDPR compliance on an ongoing basis. And in particular, that means having processes in place to keep the data register up to date, train new staff in their data protection responsibilities. And if you're processing data in new ways, or if you're collecting new data, or transferring data to a third party, you have to make sure you're complying with all your obligations. So having a legal basis for processing and informing employees and other data subjects of how their data is being used and so on. And then importantly, if you're bringing in any new procedures, you need to be thinking about the data protection implications of anything new that you're doing.
Yes, and in fact, employers should particularly think about privacy impact assessments when they're introducing new procedures. And that's actually something that employers have asked us for help on. They're specifically required by the GDPR if an employer is carrying out systematic and extensive automated profiling, large-scale processing of special categories of personal data and criminal records data, and large-scale systematic monitoring of a publicly accessible place. So I'd say employers are most likely to have to do an impact assessment if they're using new technology such as AI to process personal data, tracking individuals' locations of behaviour, including online behaviour. So the example that we use is the introduction of CCTV monitoring in a particular location. So ongoing impact assessments are a good example of what Susie's been saying about GDPR compliance being an ongoing job for employers.
Are we expecting anything else to come out in 2019 on the GDPR?
Well, we are expecting there to be some new guidance from the Information Commissioner's Office. So we'll be looking out for that and we'll be updating our content accordingly.
And also, it's just worth mentioning as well that companies can now be fined 20 million euros or 4% of their worldwide turnover. So that's significantly more than the maximum penalty of half a million under the old Data Protection Act. So we're expecting more enforcement work of that type before the end of 2018 and 2019. One good example so far, though not an employment-related one, is a Canadian analytics firm that worked for Vote Leave, which received the first formal notice in September under the GDPR. So AIQ was accused of processing people's data for purposes that they would not have expected. So I think it's only a matter of time before we have the first example of an employment-related GDPR notice. And you really don't want to be the employer in that position, not just because of the financial implications, but also because of the negative publicity it would generate and damage it could do to employee trust.
So that's a good cautionary note to end on with the GDPR. But moving now to a completely different area, that of apprenticeships. And Noelle, We've been looking at how the apprenticeship levy might be impacting employers in 2018.
Yeah, indeed. We've had a good look at the number of apprenticeship starts and have found that the figure for 2017 and 18, just under 370,000. So that represents 125,000 fewer than in the previous 12 months. So all indications are the figures are going to be some way off the 3 million projected by 2020.
Okay, and why are we seeing such a significant reduction then?
Well, there are two schools of thought for this amongst employers. One is that it is the introduction of the levy itself, and that's had an impact on the number of starts. Essentially, that employers are just getting used to the mechanics of the levy process and applying for apprenticeships, etc., and that numbers will begin to pick up once again, once everyone is more comfortable with the process. However, there's another school of thought that the levy is simply not fit for purpose, and that it has turned employers away from engaging with the work-based training scheme, that the funding arrangements are unsatisfactory and that employers see it as just another tax, and also that the actual apprenticeship framework and the training that is provided isn't quite fit for purpose. Employers are used to being able to tailor the training that they can offer to apprenticeships more, but the latest framework currently allows for less, not more of that.
We'll be coming on to Brexit later, but just looking at how it might affect apprenticeships, should employers be preparing for the potential impact of Brexit?
Well, the thing is that apprenticeships should and could be a proactive and productive way of dealing with the inevitable skill shortages as a result of Brexit. With fewer EU citizens applying for roles in the UK, that means employers need to generate more homegrown talent. And given that almost 90% of apprentices are in the services sector, this apprenticeship framework really should give employers the opportunity to develop the skills and experience they need, but that's just not quite happening yet.
How are small employers responding to the apprenticeship programme?
Yeah, small employers are really not fans currently. There's been a distinct lack of engagement among small employers, and the funding requirements of them of 10% really isn't popular. But the thing is that small employers should be the perfect home for apprenticeships and apprentices. It's a place where apprentices can benefit from a wide range of experience and a wider exposure to all areas of the business. And it means that smaller business can really produce a perfectly rounded employee for them going forward. But there has been a change to the funding arrangements announced. Philip Hammond announced in the budget that he will be changing the contribution level for small employers from 10% to 5%. Initially, that was supposed to happen in 2019, but latest indications are there's no set date yet.
It's worth pointing out as well that the government's already making some changes to encourage small employers to use apprenticeships. And also the other key thing they're trying to do is provide more flexibility as to how employers use their funds. So a change was made in April 2018 to allow employers to transfer up to 10% of their annual apprenticeship fund to another organisation. This transfer facility was extended to multiple organisations from August 2018. And then is the change in the contribution for small employers that Noel was talking about.
But Stephen, are we likely to see a wider consultation on the levy in the future, do you think?
Yes, it's worth just mentioning that the government's promised a consultation to look at how the levy will operate after 2020. So it's really taking stock of how it's working. And that should be an opportunity for employers to have their say in how the levy is working so far.
Okay, well, moving on to our next area for discussion, which is gender pay gap. And a significant development of 2018 has been pay reporting, and specifically the first gender pay gap reports have been filed, haven't they, Noel?
Yes, indeed. So this was a real landmark, wasn't it, for 2018? Over 10,500 reports were published to date for 2019. That's standing at 417. But if we look at what the reports tell us from 2018, we can see that there's a median gender pay gap of just under 10%, 9.3%, and an average pay gap of 13.3%. Alongside that, we have seen that the top quartile band for earnings is made up of just under two-thirds men and one-third women.
And for people looking at their 2019 gender pay gap reports, what deadlines should people have in mind?
Well, this is now an annual requirement for employers who are obliged to report. And so public sector organisations must publish reports by midnight on the 30th of March, and for private sector organisations, midnight on the 4th of April. And these reports are to be based on a snapshot date. So that's the 31st of March 2018 for public sector organisations and 5th of April for private sector employers.
Now here at Expert HR, we've done a bit of research into how employers have been acting on a gap. What does the research tell us so far?
We've heard from over 150 employers who told us that they are generally adopting a root and branch approach to addressing their organisation's gender pay gap. Just under half were reviewing recruitment processes. So this means ensuring that women are encouraged to apply for all roles. So looking at where jobs are advertising, ensuring that flexible working opportunities are transparent and encouraged. One third of those we heard from are looking at revising promotion processes. So this again will go some way towards addressing that imbalance at the upper quartile there. So they're working on ensuring more women remain on the same career track as their male counterparts. And we found that fewer organisations are throwing money at salaries. So instead, they're looking to change the culture of organisations to ensure a more long-term solution, really.
And I think something that's probably surprised people is the amount of media attention that the gender pay gap has received. And its profile means that the gap has the potential to create reputational damage and issues around recruitment. What do you think about that?
Oh, absolutely. The gender pay gap got a lot of attention. And because employers have to publish their reports and make them available online, therefore, front and square in the public domain. So employers really do need to think about that report and the narrative and the context that they provide. The report is an opportunity for them to detail the steps they will be taking for any existing gap. But of course, that will then need to be backed up in action, as employees will be able to look back over time at the gap and the narrative on an annual basis and track any changes over time.
And I think it's probably just worth reminding listeners that we have our own gender pay gap reporting service here at Expert HR that can take you beyond the legal minimum. So it helps you to understand year-on-year trends, drivers behind your organisation's pay gap, and to see the detailed breakdowns by department and age group. So sticking with the theme of pay reporting, Stephen, we have a new pay reporting obligation coming in early next year around executive pay.
So on 1st of January 2019, legislation comes into force requiring UK coded companies with more than 250 employees to publish the pay ratio between their CEO and average employees. So it's slightly different to the other reporting requirements we're talking about today, like gender pay gap reporting. That's because they're part of corporate governance reforms and are being introduced to tackle executive pay scandals, such as CEOs being rewarded for failure.
So that makes it a bit difficult to predict the impact on HR.
That's right. So we don't really know the impact. As a company reporting issue, it may be led more by the business side of things, but I could see HR or payroll being asked to have some involvement in the calculation and preparation of the numbers. That's particularly given their previous expertise gained in working on gender pay gap reporting and the fact that the gender pay gap figures can be used as a basis for these figures. HR may also be involved in terms of the message that's provided to staff once the figures have been published, with some employees possibly being disgruntled if they see a huge pay gap. So it'll be interesting to see how much HR professionals are involved in this in 2019.
Okay, but in brief, will people be reporting on it in the same way as the gender pay gap, do you think?
So there's various methods companies can use. One of them is to use their most recent gender pay gap information to identify three UK employees whose pay places one on a lower pay level, one on a median pay level, and one on a higher pay level. And then basically the pay of those three is then set against the CEO's pay.
And I think this is a real change, isn't it? The fact that there's going to be a whole new level of transparency around pay, and employers are going to have to justify what they're paying CEOs, and employees are going to get a real insight into how their salaries compare. And it's not just the upper quartile, it's the lower quartile as well. So I think this could be really transformational for the way pay moves forward in the future.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see how it pans out. What are the reporting deadlines for it?
And actually it's coming very soon, so they're quite for companies to publish their executive pay ratio applies to company reporting for financial years beginning on or after 1st of January 2019. So we're likely to see the first figures in company reports from early 2020.
So looking now at what may be coming down the line in terms of pay reporting, Fiona, pay reporting based on ethnicity may be the next area we see.
Well, following a review and an audit, the government became aware that more work needs to be done to ensure progression for all ethnic groups in the workplace. And the government considers that transparency is a vital first step. And with this in mind, it's exploring mandatory ethnicity pay reporting by employers. So on the 11th of October, it began a consultation on ethnicity pay reporting, and it's seeking views on how this would best work in practice.
And I think as an employer listening to this, what maybe in your mind is what method is likely to be adopted to carry out the calculations and provide a comparison.
Well, a few organisations are already reporting voluntarily, but they're using different methodologies, and that limits comparability. So in the consultation, the government is looking to find one consistent approach.
And how is this likely to apply to employers in terms of thresholds, number of employees?
Well, the government believes the threshold should be the same as for gender pay gap reporting, which is organisations, as we know, with 250 or more employees. But it's seeking views on other options, and they are employers with 50 plus employees, or employers with 500, or indeed another threshold. And I should just mention that one of the arguments for having the duty limited to large employers is that ethnicity data, it's a special category of personal data, and organisations would need to take care to ensure the anonymity of those who provide their data. And this, of course, is going to be easier for larger organisations.
And we mentioned at the outset that this is, of course, still a consultation. When does it close?
It closes on the 11th of January next year, 2019.
So I think we should say that while employers obviously want to know about the legislation and their statutory obligations in this area, reporting pay gaps isn't an end in itself. And it's obviously only useful to report a gap if you're planning to do something about it. So there's nothing stopping employers from monitoring their figures, say on the ethnicity pay gap or disability pay gap, and they don't necessarily have to make those figures public at the moment, but they could use them to put in place an action plan to tackle the underlying causes of inequality. And you shouldn't necessarily be waiting for a statutory duty to do that.
And I should mention on that point that the government has launched the Race at Work Charter. Now, this is a charter that commits the businesses that sign up to it to key principles and actions that the government says are designed to transform the recruitment and progression of ethnic minority employees. And so it would include things like, you know, capturing data and publicising progress, committing at board level to zero tolerance of harassment and bullying, just to give a couple of examples.
And just in terms of pay reporting overall, I wouldn't be that surprised if in the future the government introduces one transparency website for employers to have to upload all of this pay information. Employers, for example, may have to upload their gender and ethnicity pay gap figures onto one central website, and that would be a place where employers could go to see what rivals are doing, and also might be useful for, say, prospective recruits.
And actually, on that point, recently the government has launched the framework to support employers to voluntarily report on disability, mental health and well-being in the workplace.
So transparency around pay and policy certainly seems to be the direction of travel at the moment. Stephen, on that note, the government recently announced that it intends to consult on a proposed requirement for employers to publish their policies on parental leave and pay.
Yes, this was something of a surprise announcement following on from a voluntary initiative that some large employers have been taking part in. The government has said that on top of the voluntary initiative, it's going to consult on requiring large employers, those with more than 250 employees, to publish their policies on leave for families.
Yeah, and on that, we actually just recently recorded a podcast with Charlotte Billett-Taylor from PwC, who were one of the 10 voluntary organisations publishing their policies online.
Yes, and PwC are actually just one of a number of large companies who've already signed up to publish their policies on leave for families online. So that includes companies like law firms Aleshaw Goddard and Linklaters and insurance provider Directline. In terms of the public sector, the government's also pledged to publish the parental leave policies of all government departments. This is after it came in for criticism that, in fact, very few ministerial departments have published their arrangements on the careers sections of their websites. The figure was actually 4 out of 25 government departments. So surprisingly few large public sector employers openly publish their family-friendly policies online.
So Stephen, what's the thinking behind the proposal?
So the government said the change would make it easier for job applicants to make informed decisions about whether they can combine a role for caring with their family. For most job applicants, they're actually reluctant to ask in interviews about an organisation's family-friendly policies. So this would make large companies' parental leave offerings much more transparent and make it easier for potential employees to choose which employer they want to work for. So, and it also makes it easier for employees to benchmark employers and then, of course, for employers to see what their rivals are offering employees in terms of family-friendly benefits.
Just to reinforce, this is still very much a proposal. It's at a very early stage. So what do you think the next step will be?
So we're due to have a consultation on this to flesh out some of the detail and also to gather views on the proposals where large employers affected will be able to put forward their thoughts.
Okay, Fiona, something else that's also speculative at this point is a potential duty for employers to consider whether a job can be done flexibly and to make that clear when they're advertising the role.
Yeah, the government published a press release on that in October in which it stated it will consider creating such a duty because the government says that working flexibly helps people to balance their work and home lives and it's vital, they say, it says, in creating an inclusive economy.
Let's move away now then from proposals to a right that is now enshrined in statute but not yet in force, and that's the right to parental bereavement leave.
This will give all employed parents a day one right to 2 weeks leave if sadly they lose a child under the age of 18 or suffer a stillbirth after 24 weeks of pregnancy. And bereaved parents will also be able to claim pay for this period subject to meeting some eligibility criteria. The leave must be taken within a period of at least 56 weeks, beginning from the date of the loss of the child. And the reason it's set at that is to include the first anniversary.
And when is the right likely to come into force?
Well, it was confirmed in the budget that the right will come into effect in April 2020. And employers may want to consider introducing the right on a voluntary basis before it becomes mandatory the year after next.
Now, moving on to an area that is at the top of people's agendas, I'm sure, Brexit. And as things seem to be changing day to day, Susie, based on what we do know at the moment, what can we say to our listeners about how freedom of movement is likely to change potentially under Brexit?
So the UK and EU have reached an agreement that provides that if you're an EU national who arrives in the UK before Brexit or during a transition period, you can stay to live and work. And when you've been here for 5 years, you get settled status and the right to stay indefinitely. And it's been agreed that the transition period will last until the end of 2020. And the agreement also covers UK nationals who live and work in the EU. Now, that's part of the withdrawal agreement, which has been approved by the other EU member states, but is obviously not a done deal. And we're recording this before the UK Parliament has voted on that agreement.
So a no-deal Brexit is still very much a possibility then. So how does that affect things?
Yes, so if that is what happens, the government has said that it will honour its commitment to allow EU nationals who are already living in the UK to stay, and it seems very unlikely that they would go back on that. So from employers' point of view, while they may be having trouble attracting new recruits from the EU, those that are already here will be able to stay. So employers may choose to help employees with their applications for pre-settled status and for settled status to make sure that the employees know what's required and that they make any applications in time.
Okay, but what about the transition period that's been agreed? Would that still stand if there's a no deal?
It's not guaranteed that the transition period will be in place in the event of a no deal Brexit. So this is the transition period that would allow EU nationals arriving between 29th of March and the end of 2020 to stay and gain settled status after 5 years. That's yet to be confirmed, although we expect that there will be a transition period in the event of no deal. Some employers will also need to think about employees who are UK nationals who live and work for them in the EU. And the position in the event of no deal for those employees is still not clear.
And do we know what the position will be for employers that want to recruit EU citizens in the future, so after Brexit and any transition period?
Not yet. The government has yet to announce the detail of the immigration rules that will apply to EU citizens coming to work in the UK after the transition period, assuming that there is one. Theresa May has said that there won't be any preferential treatment for EU citizens and that priority will be given to highly skilled workers. We're expecting a white paper on that, but as things are moving all the time, we'll update our how-to guide on preparing for Brexit when we know more.
Noelle, you've been asking employers what they've been doing about recruitment in the light of uncertainty around Brexit.
Yeah, we used our annual recruitment metrics survey to ask them if they'd been experiencing any difficulties. And we've heard quite a bit of anecdotal evidence, actually, that employers have been telling us that citizens of EU countries have already started to return home, leaving skill shortages as they're struggling to find replacements within the UK. Now, this, of course, sits alongside the fact that we're operating in a pretty tight labour market anyway, because employment levels are quite high. But employers are finding it difficult to plan ahead until they're absolutely clear about the process following Brexit. A couple of employers told us they've already set up offices outside the UK so they continue to access the EU workforce. And we've heard that some are anticipating a high turnover of employees following Brexit because many of their employees are highly skilled and desired in the industry and also eligible to work in the UK. So, you know, there's an awful lot going on there, a lot for employers to get their heads around.
Yeah, absolutely. Are they finding anything else regarding recruitment?
I suppose besides the underlying uncertainty, we've heard from some employers that they are noticing a difference in the dynamic of the applicant and also in the amount of applicants they have applying for their roles. So they're having to look at ways to increase the places where they're advertising jobs, etc. And that's having a knock-on effect in driving up the cost of recruitment for them, really.
Now, leaving the EU by whatever method has big implications for the financial services sector, Fiona.
Oh, it does indeed. Banks and financial services firms, well, they're going to lose their so-called passport, which allows them to trade freely in any EU or EEA state. And of course, it's still not clear what will be replacing that. Now, the FCA and the PRA, they've been preparing for a range of scenarios. And recently, the FCA published a further paper on its proposals if there is no deal. So given all this uncertainty, in the run-up to Brexit, banks and financial services have been reorganising their operation and some firms have been setting up new European hubs.
Yes, and of course it's not just banks, but there's numerous stories of companies seeking to minimise the fallout of Brexit by either setting up additional companies in the EU or moving their headquarters to a new country.
Do we know which companies those are, Stephen?
So it depends on the sector, of course, but we know that nearby countries to the UK, such as Holland, Belgium and Luxembourg are proving popular. Plus, of course, France and Germany are always going to be popular for some companies. The big advantage of moving to Dublin is the lack of a language barrier. And then Eastern European countries are also going to be popular because of the relatively low cost. And just to give a couple of examples of companies that are already moving, electronics company Panasonic is moving its European HQ from the UK to Holland. Lloyd's of London is establishing an insurance company in Brussels. And banks like Nomura are already setting up EU operations in Germany.
Yeah, and if you're a business considering a move, what do you need to think about briefly?
So I think there's three things initially to think about, really. What's an employee's contracts of employment? Is there a mobility clause requiring an employee to change their place of work? If there is, check how wide it is. Some big international companies such as banks may take account of relocation to an overseas location, and the employee may be required to move as part of their contract of employment. If there's no clause, some staff may be happy to move abroad, but of course for many who don't want to move, there may be a redundancy situation.
So if redundancies are envisaged, consultation is going to be important, isn't
it?
Yeah,
that's the second important thing to think about with relocation. Consultation allows various options to be explored with staff who may refuse to move, such as moving them to another post within the UK if the employer is retaining premises there. And of course, redundancy should be last resort. And then one other thing I think is just worth mentioning is that employers should consider if they can offer financial assistance to facilitate possible moves or additional travel costs. There could be a relocation incentive bonus scheme too. So I think we could see relocation assistance payments becoming an increasingly important benefit for employers in the next few years.
Well, thanks very much, everyone. We've packed a lot into what has been an exceptionally busy year for HR, and we'll, of course, keep you up to date with all the developments for 2019 on the site. Well, that brings us to the end of this special edition Expert HR podcast and for our podcasts for 2018. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to you joining us again next year.